Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Call it stubborn, persistent, durable. Whatever the word, we are not done with inflation yet. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, February 24th. Good to have you with us. Today's message that the Fed has more work to do to bring down inflation comes from the Commerce Department and its Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, which shows that inflation rose 0.6% in January, more than expected. For the year, prices were up 4.7%. And that's where we'll start our weekly wrap with Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post and Sudeep Reddy at Politico. Welcome back to both of you.
Hi, Amy.
Hey.
So, Sudeep, for about a month there, we were talking about disinflation, that is, slower inflation. What happened?
You know, I saw the numbers this morning. I thought this is a hot mess. But then I, upon reflection, would maybe call it a warm mess. But it's still a mess regardless. It's just it always seemed foolish to think that this inflation problem was going to go away with a straight line down. It's obviously not going to. We've moved, as we've discussed many times, from the goods inflation, the whole problem with supply chains and ships and everything, to services inflation, which gets more embedded in the economy. And we've seen this a train of Fed speakers in the last week come out and say this is going to be a battle that goes on for some time. They say they're not going to let up, which is why the stock market adjusted as in response to it. But they really can't let up. This is like not a battle you want to screw around with. And so they know that, and they need to beat the inflation dragon before it starts devouring more of the economy.
We've got a warm mess, an inflation dragon, lots of good metaphors to get us going. So, Catherine, we knew the Fed wasn't going to let up. They've been indicating as much. But, you know, given the news today, they're meeting in less than a month from now. How does that change the calculation?
Well, I mean, it is puzzling that after whatever it is, 8 consecutive rate hikes, we're not seeing more disinflation, more air coming out of the tires, the dragon slain, or whatever metaphor you want to use. You know, I think the best possible scenario, the most optimistic way to read these numbers is maybe they're distorted by some weird seasonality and like you shouldn't take them at face value. I mean, it's 1 month of data. You never want to read too much into 1 month of data.
Right.
And there were some weird things. You know, January was an unusually warm month. And so that's what I mean by the seasonal adjustments could have been kind of wacky. But it's that, you know, the best possible scenario being that the numbers are wrong is really not a great place to be. And I can imagine that the Fed is probably not super happy with the trends that we've seen so far, and there will be more pressure on Fed officials to act a little bit more aggressively in the months ahead.
Sudeep, what else is the Fed weighing? I mean, we've seen this inflation number. Obviously, the job market has remained strong, but we did learn this week that GDP grew more slowly in the fourth quarter. Are there any other signs that Fed policy longer term is actually working to cool off the economy?
Yeah, the weird problem for the Fed right now is that the economy is actually pretty strong. For all the times in the last 15 years we've talked about trouble in the economy, the economy's in a good place. It's fairly decent economic growth. There are all sorts of potential distortions in that. Obviously, this ridiculously strong job growth that we saw last month, I'm sure it will moderate before long, but the job market is holding up. So for the economy overall, for all of the beating that the economy's taken from the Fed, for it to be holding up this well is like, it's remarkable. I think it's surprising to all of us, as Catherine said. It's just surprising. And so for the Fed, that just means they have to keep pushing and make sure that it does not turn into a disaster that they have to clean up later. But like, it does leave like the soft landing question, but it also just opens the door to the possibility that this will be a very long road of dealing with the inflation problem.
So one place where we have seen higher interest rates doing their job, essentially cooling demand, has been in housing. And Catherine, I wanted to talk to you about that because we had news this week that sales of existing homes fell for the 12th month in a row. It's been a full year now, but new home sales have actually been picking up the past few months. And there is talk that maybe we're at or near the bottom. What do you think there?
The housing market is arguably the most interest rate sensitive part of the economy, at least that, you know, that the Fed is trying to influence right now. And interest rates do seem to be doing their job in the sense of bringing down home prices, bringing down the quantity of sales. To your question about what's going on with new home sales going up versus existing home sales going down, I wonder if that's partly just about the supply rather than demand for new homes. You know, supply was really constrained for a long time. It was difficult to build. It was difficult to get garage doors and labor and everything else that goes into building a home. So maybe, you know, given how long it took to build stuff, there's things actually finally coming on the market that are selling, you know, that it's really just about the people who were there to buy last year are finally able to buy. It could be that, you know, builders might respond more quickly to shocks like changes in interest rates. You know, they're borrowing short term. They're paying attention to the cost of capital. Maybe if you are selling an existing home, you haven't really adjusted your expectations for what sales price is reasonable. So there's weird stuff going on. But I think the general trend in the housing market is that as it gets more expensive to borrow, that's going to weigh on prices. And we will probably, you know, I think we will probably see house prices come down more. I don't think we've bottomed yet, to answer your question.
Yeah. Well, hopefully that means affordability improves for some people who've been cut out of the market. Before I let you two go, on everyone's mind today, of course, it's been 1 year since Russia invaded Ukraine. And, you know, the human toll is absolutely devastating. Some estimates say more than 300,000 people have been killed or wounded. Millions more have been displaced. And Sudeep, I wonder if you can talk about the sort of global economic impact of this war. Yesterday, we had a piece on about food insecurity. This has affected food prices and energy prices, not just in Europe, but around the world.
There are absolutely so many knock-on effects. We dealt with the chaos of the pandemic and what that did to global trade, and now we're obviously this is very different with Russia, and its sanctions have been very targeted. The global, particularly U.S. and EU sanctions, have been targeted. What we're seeing here, though, is the classic story of food and energy prices and a region that is important. It is remarkable a year later that we have not seen absolute devastation in energy markets. That is, I think, for the people who have been enacting sanctions, the success story here is that they did not wreck the global economy as a result of it. But this war is not over. They have not won. It's ongoing, and there are still all sorts of things hanging over us in the region. And you hear about China and Iran and all the other players getting involved, and that's just going to hang over sentiment for a while because it's a risk factor that's kind of lurking in the background that we'll all have to watch.
Yeah. Well, we'll end there on a sad note, but an appropriate one, I think. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. Catherine Rampell is at The Washington Post. Thank you both so much and have a good weekend.
Thanks, Amy.
Great weekend.
On Wall Street today, down, down, and more down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In that inflation report we were just talking about, we also learned that people spent a lot more in January on services like restaurants and healthcare and on goods, including vehicles, furniture, and clothing. The flip side of spending is saving, and that went up too. The personal savings rate, according to the Commerce Department, has now risen 4 months in a row. Marketplace's Justin Ho looked at what's going on there.
The Commerce Department figures out the monthly savings rate by taking people's disposable income and subtracting their spending. And even though spending rose in January, disposable income did too.
So we saw that rise about 2% in January, which outpaced spending, which is why the overall saving rate moved higher.
That's Shannon Seary, an economist at Wells Fargo. She says a lot of last month's increase in income had to do with one-off factors, including the way the Commerce Department calculates taxes in January and the recent cost of living adjustment to Social Security. But Siri says people's take-home pay has been steadily rising.
So I do think that the savings situation is improving, and that is a good indication that households do have some spending power in the months ahead.
Thing is, not every household has the same amount of spending power. Megan Green, global chief economist at the Kroll Institute, says lower-income households are burning through their savings at faster rates. Meanwhile, credit card balances have been rising.
That suggests some households are really struggling to make ends meet and are just putting expenses on credit cards.
Green says people have been steadily spending down the savings they built up early in the pandemic with the help of government relief aid. In fact, the savings rate now is below where it was in 2019.
Which suggests that households are still eating into their savings more than they usually are.
The savings rate could continue to rise this year, given that the job market is still strong and wages are rising. Lydia Bussor is senior economist at EY Parthenon.
If you look at labor market conditions right now, you can see that the labor market is still providing some support for household income.
And Bussor says people's spending could slow down if the economy starts looking more uncertain this year.
Companies are going to be turning increasingly cautious with their hiring and spending, and that's likely to lead consumers to be even more cautious with their spending.
Bussor says that could cause the savings rate to rise even more. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Okay, we've talked about saving and spending. One more piece of the consumer picture comes today from the University of Michigan, whose consumer sentiment index hit a 13-month high in February, though it's still below the historical average. How people are feeling about the economy can affect how they shop, so it seems like a good time to check in with one of our retail regulars. Philip Rollins runs Offbeat, a record and comic book store in Jackson, Mississippi.
Business right now at Offbeat is going pretty well. We've had some busy days. Stuff started to pick up. A lot of people have been buying records for like their sweetheart and stuff for Valentine's Day. So we had a big boost in that. And we started doing events again to, you know, help drive customers to come into the shop more. And been working with record labels as well for artists such as Paramore and the Gorillaz. And then we have art showings, openings coming up as well, too. Inventory right now, we're pretty stacked, honestly. I did some over-ordering, which is something I honestly need to stop doing. But we're kind of really preparing for Record Store Day and Free Comic Book Day. Those are two big days coming up in April and May. And so I want to make sure I have enough product in for those days. But as of right now, I'm doing like weekly sales to kind of curb some of a lot of the bloat that I have in the shop right now, because it is a little bit too much at this moment, because we have more stuff coming in weekly. As of right now, the biggest challenge would be just really still trying to get the name of the shop out there. I've been working with some college kids and started a lot of like a student influencer program to where they can help tell other students about the shop and what we offer here and provide, and being, you know, just more than a shop, but also a place for them to like hang out. So there's a big disconnect between college students and businesses, and a lot of college students really think there's nothing to do or nothing, or the city has nothing to offer, which isn't true at all. Over the next year, I'm kind of anxious to see what's going to happen with this location. In a couple of weeks, we have a big St. Patrick's Day parade here in the city, and I think I'm close to the parade route, so I may get some overflow, like walk-in foot traffic during that event, but yeah, I'm curious to see what would actually happen during that time. That's really it. I'm just kind of preparing to see what else, you know, being in this new location is offering and what else I can do as far as teaching people more about records and comics and the communities with those things.
Philip Rollins in Jackson, Mississippi. Coming up.
What are we fighting for? If that's not the art, if that's not the future.
Art as resistance. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gave back 336 points, 1% to finish at 32,816. The NASDAQ was off 195 points, 1.7% to end at 11,394. The S&P 500 shed 42 points, 1% to close at 3970. For the week, the Dow fell 3%, the NASDAQ slipped 3.3%, the S&P 500 subtracted 2.7%. Worst week of the year so far. Justin Ho was telling us about consumers spending more freely last month, even as their savings rose. Looking at some retail stocks, Target added 0.8%, Walmart grew 0.25%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.95%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Ever since the cryptocurrency exchange FTX collapsed late last year, calls for more regulation of the industry have been getting louder. Congress has talked about regulation, but with that body's current partisan makeup, legislation isn't likely. That leaves sorting out what to do to federal regulatory agencies. Yesterday, three of those agencies got together to warn banks about the risks of crypto-related deposits. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more.
This is the second statement on crypto in as many months from the Federal Reserve, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency.
The bank regulators are focused on the interconnections between crypto and traditional banks.
Timothy Massett is director of the Digital Assets Policy Project at Harvard and former chair of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission.
And they have wanted to limit those so as to protect the traditional banking system.
He says those limits are why regulators believe the FTX fiasco didn't cause more damage to the economy. Now, the agencies are highlighting liquidity risks when it comes to crypto. Ananya Kumar tracks cryptocurrency regulation globally at the Atlantic Council and says none of this, technically, is new regulation of crypto.
So the way that these agencies are engaging in this is through their supervisory capacity as regulators of traditional financial institutions, not as regulators of crypto.
Because it's unclear just who can regulate the crypto industry. The Securities and Exchange Commission, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission.
When we talk about some of the other agencies, namely the SEC and CFTC in this space, we know that there's an ongoing turf war.
Jared Lodeholt works on crypto issues at the law firm Ice Miller. He says banking regulators don't have that problem.
There are very clearly defined lines of who does what between the FDIC, the OCC, and the Federal Reserve.
And they aren't saying banks can't or shouldn't get into crypto, but they are saying what many experts have been telling consumers. Just be careful, you know? In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
As we talked about early in the show, it's been a year today since Russian forces invaded Ukraine. The war has cost thousands of lives and devastated many Ukrainian cities. During President Joe Biden's surprise visit to Kyiv this week, he told Ukraine's president, "The Americans stand with you." So far, the U.S. has given tens of billions of dollars worth of aid to Ukraine, far more than any other country. Most of it is for military and humanitarian purposes. But Ukraine has other, less publicized needs as well. From our European desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports on the cultural resistance to the Russian invasion.
In a subway station in Kyiv, scores of people shelter from a Russian missile attack. And they burst impromptu into a Ukrainian folk song. This, says theater producer Viktor Ruban, is another form of resistance.
The aim of this war is destroying the culture and the language and the identity of Ukrainians, which doesn't fit in the Soviet box that Russia is trying to put everybody back to.
Ruban, co-producer of this dystopian drama about war, says that he and his fellow artists are performing an important role, asserting the Ukrainian identity that Putin is trying to flatten. But artists like Ruban get a lot of their funding from the government, and early in the war, officials delivered a difficult, though understandable, message.
They immediately wrote that we are sorry, but we have to give our budget to the army. So there will be no funding for the independent scene for this year.
Funding for the performing arts has been cut by 100% for the independents and more than 50% for the state sector. That's the big theatres, opera houses and ballet companies. Bard says independent theatre director Alex Borovensky, the vast majority of companies are still in business.
We were able to survive only by the private donations from our friends, theatre makers and international supporters. We got a lot of support from UK, from Europe, from USA, but only private.
Many theatre buildings have been damaged in the war. Others have been turned into centres for humanitarian aid, while the companies have relocated to smaller makeshift premises, often underground. Performances curtailed by the curfews, disrupted by the constant blackouts, and interrupted by the frequent air raids. But, says Borovensky, the companies have kept going.
Yes, Ukrainian theatres do have a lot of hardships and troubles, but at the same time, every Ukrainian theatre put up new productions even in 2022.
Productions of every genre. This one, called Putin's Trial, examines the impact of autocracy, while this one is a light-hearted farce that's played to tiny audiences of around 30 in a cellar under a theatre not far from the front of the war with Russia. This production, called Agora, looks to the future and explores the kind of society Ukraine will become after the war. This song, by the way, is in Greek, underlining Ukraine's openness to other cultures, except one, which is definitely out of bounds, says culture organiser Veronika Sklyarova. No Ukrainian theatre or concert producer, she says, will touch any Russian material, however transcendent. She says it's all been irredeemably tainted by the invasion.
This culture, they have this foundation and they came here to kill. They're coming here, raping Ukrainian women, killing our kids. There is no space for Russian culture for anyone.
And that includes Tchaikovsky and Tolstoy?
Definitely, and Tchaikovsky and Tolstoy.
Ukrainian artists are mostly looking westward now, not least for financial support. Producer Viktor Ruban has raised around $130,000 from the US and Europe to help his struggling colleagues. Theatre director Alex Borovensky says, in the welcome drive to pour money into repelling the Russian military, donors should not forget the arts.
What are we fighting for? If that's not the culture, if that's not the art, if that's not the future.
Call it the second front against the Russians, Ukraine's very own culture war. At the European Desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. Are you earning more than you were 10 years ago? USA Today looked at how different occupations have fared over the past decade. Airplane pilots, dancers, and software developers saw the biggest salary increases, percentage-wise, with pilots making about 25% more, adjusted for inflation, and dancers and developers around 7% more. At the lowest end of the scale, dentists earned 23% less after inflation, actors down 19%, and architects minus 17%. The small business lender Clarify Capital crunched numbers from the Labor Department and also found that while the average salary for all occupations grew by 31% over the decade, add inflation to the picture and that average actually fell 4.5%. All right, here's your moment of economic context. On the anniversary of the war in Ukraine, the White House announced a new 200% tariff on Russian aluminum starting March 10th. Aluminum from Russia has in the past accounted for about 10% of U.S. imports, according to ING, but that's fallen since the invasion of Ukraine. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fergali. Donna Tam is the executive editor.
Neil Scarborough is the Vice President and General Manager. And I'm Amy Scott. Have a good weekend. We'll be back on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.